people were able to travel from place to place. For example, 2 Samuel 18, verses 18 through 33, is the story of how men ran from the place of battle to the place where David the king was waiting to give him the news his son Absalom had died. 2 Samuel 18, verse 24, and David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate under the wall and lifted up his eyes, and behold, a man running alone. This was a common way of sharing news. A person could run to report a verbal message, as in the case of the scripture just cited, or one could carry a written message as they traveled from place to place. In Philippians 2, verse 25, Paul mentions Epaphroditus as the messenger of the Philippians who had carried their gifts to him and was now returning with his letter. Paul says, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me, Philippians 2 and verse 30. In the history of the United States, there have been many advances in increasing the speed of travel and communication. One of the first books I was given as a boy told the story of the first overland mail and how John Butterfield's horse and mule-drawn stagecoaches set speed records in 1858 when they transported the U.S. mail from St. Louis to San Francisco in 23 days, 23 and a half hours. While the railroads did exist then, they were only in the East. But the West was starting to be populated, particularly in Salt Lake City by the Mormons and in California by the gold miners, and there was a need for regular mail service from back east. The coast-to-coast connection for the railroad was completed in 1869, making stagecoach journeys unnecessary, and then later advances in travel include automobiles, trucks, and airplanes. And while all of these have purposes of transporting people and goods, they are also used to help speed up communication faster than someone can run. When the world of electricity came into existence, communication was one of its first applications. The advantage is obvious because a person does not have to travel with the message can travel by itself. Other attempts to do this were not so reliable, such as the beating of drums, smoke signals, carrier pigeons. Each of these have some pretty severe limitations. With electricity came the telegram in 1844, which was later joined by the telephone in 1876, for which we have circled the globe with wire so we can talk. In the last few years, telephones have gone wireless and greatly commercialized. Cellular phones have revolutionized speech communication today to a level never before imagined. At one time, a telephone was constructed like a piece of furniture that hangs on a wall. In order to talk on it, you had to stand up and face the phone. Telephones have gone from being a luxury of the rich to a necessity in our homes and something we very much take for granted. And in many areas, cellular phones are almost as common. Not long ago, in our van, we had Ty and Chris and Rochelle going together somewhere. Between us, we had four cellular phones. We would have had five, but Chris didn't bring his with him. We nearly have to call each other even when we're together just to talk. Now, we think very little of this, but it's a stark contrast when you travel in a country like Russia, for example, where even the public telephones are few and far between and rarely work, and people have to wait months and even years to get a phone. Visual images have been commonly preserved through the years by drawings and paintings. As recently as the beginning of our nation, the only things we have that give us the likeness of George Washington are artist portraits of him. The Revolutionary War was only captured by paintings and drawings, but by the time of the Civil War, in the mid-1800s, photographs were possible. We have gone from that rudimentary process to digital cameras today, like Brian Osborne had Jimmy Winchester's camera with him last night. They record an image that can be easily modified and duplicated. Along the way, the process was developed to film people and objects in motion, hence the name moving or motion pictures. Movies were born, first silent and then later with sound. That developed into the specialized process that produces movies, but also produces the simplified equipment of video cameras today, also very common. What does all of this have to do with the internet? Well, the internet is not a new means of communicating and sharing information. The internet takes common means of communication and entertainment and makes them accessible in a new way. For example, writing letters is not new. Letters have been written for thousands of years, as we know. But now it is possible to write, send, and receive letters to and from people via computer using the internet. Not only possible, but extremely easy. Talking to someone on a telephone is not new. That technology has been around a long time. Now it's possible to buy software and equipment so that you can use the internet to make phone calls all over the world and therefore bypass long-distance charges for the most part. My brother-in-law, Win Baker, has and uses this type of equipment. Listening to music is not new. The technology to listen to music has been around since Thomas A. Edison's invention of the phonograph in 1877, but now via the internet it is possible to listen to thousands of songs. Reading a book is not new. The ability to print a book has been around a long time thanks to Gutenberg, but now it is possible to put the image of the printed book on the internet where people who will never see the book in person can find it, read its pages, and print it out if they choose. The taking of photographs is not new, but now the ability to put pictures on the internet is possible via the digital process. Those pictures range from innocent photographs of people, places, and things to the most horrible pornography. Video cameras are not new. Many movies have been made through the years, and many families have video cameras, as we have one here today. But now the ability to put cameras in the internet and thereby have live pictures is possible. So there can be a daycare center that has a camera that is hooked up to the internet where parents can check on their children at any time. There's also a wild bear area in Alaska where someone has set up a live camera. San Francisco's Bay Bridge has one as well that you can look at for traffic updates. And then it ranges from those practical and innocent uses to individuals who have cameras in their home that are on 24 hours a day to entice voyeurs to access their websites. The playing of games is not new. There are thousands of games to play, but now with the internet, the ability to play games remotely is possible. A man that I know at work plays Civil War games with his brother, and they email their moves back and forth. There are internet games that are interactive where you sign on for live play with people around the world. The Wall Street Journal has recently been reporting world chess champion Garry Kasparov playing chess against the world via the internet. The buying of goods and services is not new, but now the internet has connections to millions of websites that allow the purchases of goods and services. You want to buy a house? Home listings for many communities are on the internet. You want to go on a near virtual tour of a home where you can see each room from any angle? That is available. You want to buy a plane ticket? Many travel services are available. Want to buy a book? There are links available offering millions of them. Want to tour a museum? There are many sites available that take you from room to room to see the treasures there. Want to participate in an auction to buy about anything? There are many of those. Want to buy groceries and have them delivered to your home? My boss's daughter uses that service in Portland. She has two small babies and another one on the way. And it's much easier to access the website of the local new grocery distributor and select items from her repetitive list rather than go to the grocery store. They select a two-hour window when she agrees to be at home for the delivery. The delivery person arrives who cannot be tipped. The cold things are in a cold storage chest. The hot things are likewise protected. Everything else is in bags taken out of plastic totes, laid on her kitchen counter, and the prices are competitive with a grocery store, and she hasn't had to leave her home. That service is expanding to many areas soon. As you can see, in many ways, the internet is not anything new. What is new is the ability to combine so many means of communication and entertainment into one medium. Originally, the idea of the internet grew out of an idea developed by the military so there could continue to be communications if there was widespread destruction in our nation. The theory is that many communication lines linking to many different computers would always have some that could work rather than just one or two computers that could be destroyed and destroy all communications. To use the internet requires a computer with a modem and a connection to a phone line. Once you have an internet service provider software, you are ready to go. The cost is quite negligible. In addition to equipment costs, you pay for the right to use the service provider software and for a telephone connection from your computer to an internet server in your area. As long as the connection to the server is a local call, it costs nothing to access internet sites all over the world. Traffic on the World Wide Web of the internet has grown at an astronomical pace, with an estimated 121 to 200 million users around the world today, with the vast majority being in North America. One prediction estimates that there will be as many as 545 million internet users by the year 2003. I don't think it would be wise to say the internet is another hula hoop. I believe it's here to stay. I think it will only become more common in days to come. Several different types of communication are available via the internet. We will look at those that are most common. It allows one-to-one individual communication where each person can type in another person's address and send them mail via their computers with the touch of a few keys, just like sending a letter through the mail, only it is sent instantly and without the cost of postage. The only cost incurred is the cost of the phone service from your computer to the server computer that connects you to the web. When I sign on to AOL, America Online, the service provider that I use, if I have any messages from anyone, there's a spoken voice from my computer that says, "You've got mail." Well, who can you send mail to? Anyone with an internet address, anywhere in the world. Now, the internet also allows instant communication in various ways, but the one I'll concentrate on most today has to do with chat rooms, where multiple individuals are on the internet at the same time, sharing a common site, sending and receiving messages that appear on the screen instantly for all who share in that site to see. The internet also allows the sharing of information through web pages or home pages. This is where anyone with the funds to do so, whether person, company, organization, or government entity, can have their own site on a server computer and post information of their choice. Accesses to sites may be password protected for limited access or not protected at all, so individuals can access the posted information at any time. They may be advertised widely so people will go to their site, or they may not be advertised at all but just found when people do searches. Now, all of this mostly sounds very innocent, so why should we as Christians be concerned and examine this? Because every time any type of communication or entertainment is going to become part of our lives, I believe we need to look at it closely to see if it should be embraced, avoided, or somewhere in between as God's people. We do not want to be surprised by something that is wrong. 2 Corinthians 2 verse 11 says, "Lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." Now, since there's nothing new in what I have talked about, many would say, what's the big deal? The internet just allows you to do a lot of things that have been done before. But I think there are some very real and present dangers that we need to consider carefully with the internet. The first of these being, it is very highly addictive. There's a study that was just presented at the American Psychological Association and released to the Associated Press August 23rd. Now, this study says things like this. 6% or almost 11 million users suffer from some form of addiction to the World Wide Web. Marriages are being disrupted. Kids are getting into trouble. People are committing illegal acts. People are spending too much money. As someone who treats patients, I see it, says David Greenfield, a therapist and researcher who conducted the study. Now, the questions that were used to investigate internet addiction are the same or similar questions to those used for gambling addiction. Now, Greenfield says that there's a power here that's different than anything we have dealt before. And his analysis suggests that internet users' feelings of intimacy, timelessness, and a lack of inhibition all contribute to the addictive force of the internet. The Illinois Institute for Addiction Recovery says that internet addiction has been described as an impulse control disorder, which does not involve use of an intoxicating drug and is very similar to pathological gambling. And the Center for Online Addiction says signs for internet addiction include the following: preoccupation with the internet, use of the internet in increasing amounts of time, repeated unsuccessful attempts to control, cut back, or stop, feelings of restlessness, etc., when attempting to cut down, online longer than originally intended, jeopardize or risk loss of significant relationships, job, etc., because of internet use, lies to family members and others to conceal the extent of involvement, and the use of the internet as a way to escape from problems. What makes it so addictive? The Center for Online Addiction says, "The internet itself is a term which represents different types of functions that are accessible online. Generally speaking, internet addicts tend to form an emotional attachment to the online friends and activities they create inside their computer screens. They enjoy those aspects of the internet which allowed them to meet, socialize, and exchange ideas with new people through highly interactive internet applications such as chatting, playing online games, or being involved with several news groups. These virtual communities create a vehicle to escape from reality and seek out a means to fulfill an unmet emotional and psychological need. On the internet, you can conceal your real name, age, occupation, appearance, and your physical responses to anyone or anything you encounter online. Internet users, especially those who are lonely and insecure in real life situations, take that freedom and quickly pour out their strongest feelings, darkest secrets, and deepest desires. This leads to an illusion of intimacy. But when reality underscores the severe limitations of relying on a faceless community for the love and caring that can only come from actual people, internet addicts experience very real disappointment and pain. Now, one of the questions that I was asked to address is, if I spend all of my time chatting on the internet, does God care? Well, chatting, if you recall, is where multiple individuals can send dialogue back and forth at the same time. It's also possible in a chat room environment to go private, where individuals can go to a private place where just the two people have a private chat back and forth. It is also then possible to set up special places where you have the code word or the address of that site, and others do as well, to where just you and a few select people can share in that site. I have a book that I use in premarital counseling called Too Close, Too Soon. And it describes the way that men and women develop relationships. Now, this chart is very fascinating to me. And you'll notice on this side it says a commitment for men, and on this side is a commitment for women, and how those relationships progress for each of those. Well, what starts is just a social friendship type relationship. And when individuals are chatting on the internet, this is where they begin. They begin at an acquaintance level. And this may be in a chat room of many people where they type messages back and forth and decide that this is a nice person that they would like to get to know. That then leads to a closer friendship, such as a casual friendship, and then a close relationship as a friend, and then an intimate relationship as a friend. All of this can be done and fulfilled via writing of any sort, whether in letters or via the internet. But the internet, because of its ease of use, speeds up this process drastically. What follows for women is the emotional side of the commitment, where after someone has spent a lot of time together, they long for association with this person. If denied, they would cry over the lack of association with this person. They would be defensive of their relationship with this person. They have a commitment to this person. On the man's side, what is typical in the development of masculine relationships is by the time a man has spent this much time in a relationship, he is ready to touch. So at this point in the relationship, men are saying, you know, it would be nice to meet you. It would be nice to see you. Women are still going through this. Now, after women achieve this commitment, then they are ready for touching. Men have been ready for a long time. Men will then start the longing for, crying over, defensive of, and committed to emotional side of the relationship. So you have men screaming to meet on the internet from a pretty early time, women finally reaching that point, and now is when you see teenagers and women and men leaving their families, their children, abandoning the things that they should hold valuable and leaving to meet these people that they've been talking to on the internet. Now, there is a point of no return in this process, and I will guarantee you this, that when individuals are involved in this, the last thing in the world they want to talk about is how what they're doing is wrong. The first thing they want to tell you is how what they're doing is nice. But I'll tell you what, there's a power going on here that's evil. And it's on the news all the time. And it's in the church. It's in the Lord's church. It's in women in the church. It's in young people in the church. It's in men in the church. It's in people who claim to be leaders of the Lord's church. And it is a shame and it is a disgrace. Now, a few years ago at 64th Street, we had a lady from the southern part of the state who showed up with a man who was not her husband. She'd left her husband of 27 years and moved north to be with the man she'd been chatting with on the internet. What happened to them? Well, they reached a point where his persuasion finally matched what she was ready to do, and that's when she came up and moved in with him and became his lover. And what scared me to death was this. She came to church without shame, sitting right there in an adulterous relationship with a man who was not her husband. Now, this is just absolutely horrible for the Lord's church. Perhaps you, like me, know of married people who are gradually abandoning their spouses, and their families are being torn apart over the internet because they have these so-called friends that they are spending their time with chatting over the internet. I'll guarantee you what always happens. If this continues, you will hear of these people meeting. Why are they meeting? They're meeting because they've got to touch. Now, this is a courtship. You can call it anything you want to, but it's a courtship, plain and simple. Remember, this is an illusion of intimacy. Now, I believe this is a strong delusion. It may not fit the papacy picture, but it's a strong delusion. And I'll tell you, people are believing a lie when they're involved in this. Now, I'm going to pound on this, and if I hurt some feelings, let them be hurt. But I hope to save some families by this message. The internet makes it possible for married men and women to spend hour after hour getting to know women they are not married to, and married women to spend hour after hour getting to know men they're not married to. When that happens out in the open, we call it wrong. But on the internet, we call it a chat. That's not a chat, that's a date. And it's dangerous. I don't believe a Christian has business chatting with people they don't know, period. Now, many chatters will say, I know these people. I chat with them all the time. They are my friends. To which I respond, these people are not your friends. You are keeping them from reality just as they are keeping you from reality. This is an escape from reality. It's an illusion of intimacy. And to people who are caught up in this, they need to take the modem out of their computer and have nothing at all to do with the internet. These are serious denials of reality, and these people need psychological help. And let me tell you this, if these same individuals would put the same effort into their spouse and into their children and into serving the Lord's church in legitimate means, the church would be far better off. Please do not waste my time by telling me I'm going to chat with these people to counsel them or study them or convert them via the internet. I believe it's dangerous. I found the New American Standard translation of 2 Timothy 2:16 and 17 to be very interesting. It says, but avoid worldly and empty chatter. Now that's just close enough. Avoid empty chatter, for it will lead to further ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene. Now there's an appropriate amount of time that a man may visit with a woman who's not his wife, and a woman may visit with a man who is not her husband, and beyond that we should be uncomfortable. We observe those regulations even in this crowd at our breaks. If any married woman among us went to a corner of this building and visited with a man for a couple of hours, you know, we would notice. We would look to see who she's visiting with to make sure it is appropriate. If it were a lady with her father or one of her physical brothers or her husband, we would think nothing of it. But if she were to spend that much time with just about anyone else, we would think it's strange and not appropriate. There better be a special reason for that conversation. We would think less about that if a lady were with a preacher of the gospel and they were standing aside talking about something. When that happens to me, I always stay within sight, and I always share whatever is going on with my wife to protect my relationship. You see, in private, I will not see a woman alone in a troubled relationship situation or even in a study situation. It just would not be appropriate because, as 1 Thessalonians 5:22 says, we are to abstain from all appearance of evil. Now, I know that our young people do join together in a chat room. to discuss things back and forth. Now, I believe that this particular chat room, at least the last time I investigated, is a safe environment for our young kids, because you have to have an exact address, a password, if you will, to be able to get into this. And that is not supposed to be shared with anyone that is not known by our young people. I think this can be compared to our young kids standing around visiting after church. As long as the group stays together, I believe it can be okay, as long as nothing inappropriate is said and as long as everyone stays in the group. Now, the minute two people of the opposite sex leave the group, that's a date. And the same safeguards apply. If someone unknown has joined the group, no one, not even of the same sex, should go to a private room with them. Now, no reasonable young person would leave a group of kids they know, get in the car of a stranger, and drive off for a night on the town. Why? Because our mother gave us good advice when she said, don't talk to strangers. The same thing applies on the internet. If you're going to chat, I suggest you stay only with people you know and avoid talking with people that would put you in a compromising relationship with those you hold dear. How do we get to know people? Well, we meet them on our terms. We meet them in a safe, controlled environment. I'm telling you, the internet removes those controls, and Satan is waiting to take advantage of us. Well, some chat rooms may be okay. G.V. Ayers' mother's family has a private chat that individuals can sign onto. It's just that small group. They know each other. Past that, I would be very, very careful. Now, Ephesians 5 says that we should redeem the time in verse 16. When married people spend their time on the internet, they end up defrauding their spouse because of the time and emotional commitment that is given to others. That leads to a loss of intimacy in the relationship. I mentioned one lady that I know of who left her husband for an internet lover. She is not the only one that I know of. I know of at least two others who have done the same, and other young people just in California who have got caught up in this. Now, can internet chats between strangers lead to romantic involvement? We know the answer to that is yes. Can internet chats between strangers, which lead to romantic involvement, make successful marriages? Now, let me answer this very carefully. If a couple depends on the internet relationship to be the basis of their relationship and to carry them through life, I don't think the relationship will be successful. And here's why. If one out of two marriages ended in divorce before the popularity of the internet, when people got to know each other mostly on a face-to-face basis, the odds of a relationship being successful based only on an internet romance are roughly the same as finding a good biscuit at the bottom of the slot bucket. While it's statistically possible, it's going to be pretty rare. Now remember this, when a couple believe they know each other because of internet chats, they only have an illusion of intimacy. If that relationship is to succeed, it would only be because they discard the value of everything they have done online and they start over as complete strangers, because that is what they are. But most of the time, they're into a world of fantasy where they will not do that. The darker side of the internet involves pornography. No longer are dirty magazines behind a counter covered. They can literally be in your face. And as you can see, there are 70,000 sex-related sites on the internet. In April of 1998, 9.6 million people logged on to the 10 most popular sex sites. Pornography is alive and well on the internet, and it is dangerous. I was asked whether or not looking at pornography is fornication. I don't believe it constitutes fornication, but I do believe it's included in lasciviousness. And that is condemned in Galatians 6 and 5 as one of the works of the flesh. And Vine says that that is excess or absence of restraint. It is indecency. It is wantonness. And the prominent idea is that of shameless conduct. Such would also be condemned as a worldly lust, Titus 2 and verse 12. Now, the reasons why pornography in any form is wrong is included in such things as God intends there to be a privately shared ownership of bodies between spouses, and only between spouses. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 4 says, the wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. I think what that verse means, part of it at least, is that a man's body not only belongs to him, it also belongs to his wife. A wife's body not only belongs to her, It also belongs to her husband. There are hardly any exceptions to this, such as, for example, when we are treated by a physician. Proverbs chapter 5, beginning with verse 15 and going through verse 23, proves that our standard of satisfaction in all areas of physical intimacy is supposed to be fulfilled in our spouse. The first verse of that says, "Drink waters out of thine own cistern and running waters out of thine own well." And a man is to be completely satisfied in all ways with his wife. Viewing pornography in any form sets up a different standard of satisfaction from what God intends. In fact, pornography becomes the devil's tool because a person seeks satisfaction with an insatiable thirst for more that cannot be quenched. By contrast, God's standard is complete satisfaction with the person to whom we have vowed to be married for life. So pornography is not for single people because God wants them to save their bodies and their minds for the one they will marry. Pornography is not for married people because our spouse is intended to be our complete standard of satisfaction in intimacy. Another danger of the internet is the appearance of credibility. Just because someone has their own website does not mean what they have to share is credible. It's kind of like buying a bridge. It looks good. But that doesn't mean that it's yours to buy. The cult Heaven's Gate, whose leader and members committed suicide, designed websites as a revenue source. I remember hearing that their site was very professional in its appearance, even though their message and their purpose was evil. Perhaps you, like me, learned in high school that a typed paper was given a better grade than a handwritten paper, even if the material was exactly the same. Why is that? Because the typed paper looked better. It looks official. On the internet, just about any website can look official. I was asked to answer the question, how could a website be controlled and who's responsible for its contents? Well, as this issue pertains to the church, there is no official Church of Christ webpage, nor will there be. Now, individuals may work with congregations who have decided to have such a site, such as the Church of Christ on Exchange Parkway in Allen, Texas, as edited by David Reisner. Other sites are owned by individuals, including sites by young people. Virtually anyone can have their own website on the internet and post materials of their choosing there. But the only way I know of to control such a site is either through influence with the individual or through the congregation who has influence with that individual. Now, if a website is objectionable, the best thing to do is avoid it altogether. It's like a TV channel that you don't like. Leave it alone. You do not have to go there. And in the case of websites, let them die the death of obscurity that they deserve. But I would make this recommendation. If you do not like a website, make 2 phone calls or write 2 letters or 2 emails. One, to tell the individual that you do not appreciate or agree with what they're doing on their site. And the other, to the leadership of the congregation where they worship, telling them of what you have seen and how you do not agree with this. This is not a private sin when individuals post trash on their websites that requires us to go privately to an individual. This is like a billboard. And if you saw something going down the highway at 60 miles an hour that shocked and insulted you by one of our brethren somewhere, you would say, oh, that's their business. No, you do something about it. Go straight to the leadership and expose this wrong for what it is. A website is not a license for the airing of false doctrine that is exempt from the disciplinary process of the church. Now, this is a new area for congregations leaders to consider that I believe to be most important. If a member of the church were to start their own radio program, we would not ignore that. We would say we need to listen to make sure it's okay. A website should be considered the same way. What that means, gentlemen, as leaders, is that we have to know our flock in this area. We have to know if anyone in our congregation has a website and what they're doing with it. Why? Because it is a public medium of information that is being broadcast to the world. And if a congregation would not let a man teach in their pulpit, why would they let the same man spread things from his website and ignore that? What a person puts on their website is not their own business. It is not exempt from scrutiny because of its very public nature. Instead of creating a website and being content to let people come to their site, some individuals create documents and send them out in mass mailings to as many people as possible. In the world of regular mail service, we call this junk mail. In the internet, for some reason unknown to me, it's called spam. Now, I regret that. I happen to like spam. And when I packed to go to Russia, it was one of my favorite things, and Brother Max Butler and I just share a love of that over there. So this is a horrible insult to me of this good product. But now here's the danger. Any email sent to anyone can appear to be an official statement of the doctrine of the church, and it may just be junk mail. In my email, there have been several proclaimed, self-proclaimed town criers or brotherhood criers who feel an obligation to share their views through a barrage of email messages. Now, if someone sends me an email message, my presumption is they know me and have something to share with me that they presume I am interested in. It is very presumptuous of a stranger to send anyone an email and presume they're going to welcome that intrusion into their lives. It's as bad as a salesman at dinner time, as far as I'm concerned. Now, in the last year or so, there's been a man in Africa, G.K. Banda, who assumes I want to know of differences he has with brethren in Africa and America. Mark Boutros, of I don't know where, assumes I want to know his opinion that we should use wine in the communion. Andrew Ong of Malaysia presumes I am interested in his views on a whole host of issues. Ray Dowland of Joplin, Missouri, assumes I want to know about his views in favor of using instruments in worship. None of these men are right in their presumptions. Now, 1 Thessalonians 5 talks about knowing those who labor among us in verses 12 and 13. This verse is in the contextual setting of a local congregation, but the fact still remains when someone is giving us spiritual advice, they are attempting to labor among us. And before we accept their words as truth, we need to know who these people are. We need to know them, to have regard for them before we pay attention to them. What do we do when strangers show up at our worship? We ask them, who are you? Where are you from? Who do you know? And who knows you? And I believe that to be an absolute valid process. Why should the internet be any different? When someone sends us a message, we need to know the answers to these same questions. In Acts the 15th chapter, the Judaizing teachers were claiming to have been sent out by the authority of the Church of Jerusalem, something that was not true, but that is obviously the way they were introducing themselves, Acts 15, verse 24. And we can tell from that it is appropriate for us to tell others who we are, who knows us, and who we know when we travel from place to place so that we might be trustworthy. The same thing applies over the internet. Now, the knowledge of who is sharing information with us is very important in the church. 2 Timothy 2 verse 2 says, the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. The publications that are among us are sent forth by brethren who are known to be faithful men. Brother Don King and the editors he has chosen for the OPA, Brother Smith Bibbins and the editors he has chosen for the Expositor, all known to be faithful men throughout the brotherhood. This is necessary to give validity to those who want to labor among us with their writing. The position of an editor or publisher is very responsible. We trust them to be very careful in this responsibility and to examine that which they are to publish. I have in my possession an old letter to my grandfather, Homer Gay, from Homer King, and back and forth correspondence where my grandfather was protesting that Homer King had not published an article my grandfather had written for the OPA. Now, the issue is not who was right or wrong. The issue is that Homer King, as publisher and editor, had the right to say no thanks to an article even by another editor, which is who my grandfather was. That is the degree of care that has been exercised among us in the past in our publications. Now, who is editing these email writings from the men that I have mentioned and others? Absolutely no one. They are self-appointed publishers intruding into our lives, and I believe they're sowing discord among brethren, Proverbs 6 and verse 19. Today, anyone in the world with a computer and a little bit of knowledge can send article after article, raising issue after issue around the world to hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Now, young widows are condemned for being tattlers or gossips. 1 Timothy 5:13 says, and with all they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. Gossiping is when things are spoken that ought not to be shared. As we can see, there are things that should just not be said, and if said, they should not be repeated. And when anyone chooses to practice this, they are guilty of the same sin as that of the younger widows, of being tattlers or gossips. Now, brethren, next to the telephone, the internet is the easiest way I know of to wander about from house to house. And I think we have to be very careful here. I don't believe there can be any expectation of confidentiality in correspondence on the internet. It is very easy to forward someone else's message to as many people as you know. In fact, I think we should presume that whatever we send out to someone will likely be broadcast to others. Now, if we don't want that to happen, perhaps we should add a disclaimer to our correspondence to let the recipient know they are not at liberty to broadcast our message. Now, that's no guarantee, but it may prevent it. I happen to know that Brother Taylor Joyce wrote G.K. Banda to be removed off his mailing list, and Brother James Orton wrote Ray Downen for the same purpose. How do I know? Because Banda and Downen mailed Taylor's and James letters to everyone on their mailing list and commented on the things they had to say. Now, when we select teachers for our congregations, we are very, very careful. When a young man starts out, I remember I started out covering the first half of a chapter, and an older leader in the church covered the last half and whatever I missed from the first half. Now, who is following up with anything that is posted on the internet by anybody in the name of truth today? I don't know that anyone is. There are no qualifications for internet teachers. If any man, young or old, decides to teach on a subject, they just do. And I think that can be an issue among our young people in particular. I wouldn't discourage any of them from a study of the Word of God, but I don't believe they always have the wisdom or the knowledge to know what is best in teaching on some things in the Bible. There is a blurring of men and women's role in the internet. And I was asked to address whether or not a woman posting a message on a web page is publicly speaking. Well, I think this is a blurring of men and women's roles when messages are posted on a website. And I think in the church we have to examine each media very carefully. But I think a woman posting an opinion about a passage of Scripture on a website that everyone can access does appear to be public speaking to me. Now, let me put it this way. It has far more of an appearance of public speaking than it does private speaking. Now, if I email something about a verse to my sister in Dallas and she responds to me, that is private between the two of us. But if she posts her opinion on someone's webpage, then she is teaching the world in a very public forum. And I believe that to be a violation of 1 Timothy 2 and verse 12 regarding public teaching and usurping authority over the man. As a rule of thumb, through the years, our publications have not published articles from ladies for this very reason, lest those lines be blurred. Now, there are some final guidelines that I want to share with you before I stop for questions. For married people, stay out of chat rooms that are for the purpose of visiting, period. Just leave them alone. Now, if you want to have a special one for you and members of your family, or for you and a select group of friends, that may be appropriate, but you better be careful. Men with men, women with women, perhaps okay. If everyone is known, it's for a very special purpose, for a very specific reason. Otherwise, it can be very wrong very quickly. For unmarried people, please stay away from chat rooms unless they only involve people that you know face to face and have an already relationship with. Do not chat with strangers, and if some strangers start breaking into the group, get out of there. You don't know who you're dealing with. If you are married, be as careful on the internet with the opposite sex as you should be if you were seeing that person face to face with your spouse standing right there. If you are not married, be as careful on the internet with the opposite sex as you should be if you were seeing the person face to face with your mother beside you. Now, I hope that's some sufficient safeguards. But let me tell you this. Any email that's sent to me, I print out and share with my wife. She is not going to be surprised by what someone has sent. If you're hiding things from your spouse, you're hooked. The devil's got you, and you're in danger. And if you're not sharing what you're doing on the internet with your spouse, you need to turn that part of your computer off and leave it alone. If you, as a young person, if you're involved in chatting with somebody that you don't know, and you're going up that chart that I showed, you are playing with fire. You have no idea who that person is, and you have only an illusion of intimacy. Don't seek privacy when you access the internet. Don't use your computer when others in the family are not up and around. Don't stay on the internet when everyone else has gone to bed. Position the monitor where it can be seen by anyone who might happen to walk by. I would encourage families who have the internet to have their computer in the same room where the family spends the most time, whether the kitchen or the family room with the TV. I think it would be appropriate to have the computer right there in the room with the television so that everyone is together no matter what they're doing and everyone can see what everyone else is doing. To do otherwise, I think, is very wrong. I would also encourage particularly families to use filters or services that offer protection against profanity or sexual content or violence or race-related issues, and there are many of these available. Brother Brian Beck wrote me of this benefit. He says, what I like the most is it doesn't allow you to go somewhere accidentally where you might be tempted to explore more than you should. Also, if sites do come up, you can set your own preference to avoid them in the future and or submit a request to the provider and they will review the site. Finally, like many other things in life, the internet can be exactly what we want it to be. It can be a blessing. It can be a curse. I would hope we would cry with Joshua of old, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And let us not put our relationship with Almighty God or with our loved ones, with our brothers and sisters in Christ, at risk over the internet.